Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Yes, indeed. We bit that apple, and the garden was lost. That's a wonderful Dar Williams singing the Stolacopia song with Pete Seeger and David Burns. We are back for another hour of the Green Power Wellness Show. We had such a great time last week with Oberon Zell and Jeff Rosenbaum of the Starwood Festival, just held 10 days ago at the I guess it's 2 weeks now almost, at the Wisteria Campground in southeastern Ohio. So glad to have these guys back with me. I want to do very quickly a nuclear power update, this being the Solartopia show. The merger of Duke Power with Progress Energy has hit a snag, let's put it that way. Progress Energy is the builder, owner of the Crystal River nuclear plant in North Florida, which has four giant cracks in it. A total disaster. They spent about $2 billion trying to fix this thing, and it's worse than ever. Hopefully, it will never reopen. But the big news, unfortunately, is that the world's existence still hangs by a thread at the Fukushima nuclear plant. The first two fuel rods of over 1,300 were removed from a spent fuel pool that's flying in the air about 100 feet up. What genius came up with that idea? These are the most radioactive, most lethal substances ever created, and they are flying in the air. And if, God forbid, an earthquake comes and knocks that fuel pool over, radiation will escape and be the worst, probably the worst, most lethal event in human history. We are urging people, go to the nukefree.org website, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E, .org. We are urging the Japanese to remove these spent fuel rods as quickly and safely as absolutely possible. There's no technology really known to do this in a decent way, in a safe way, but it's got to be done as fast as possible. We do have a petition up to tell Prime Minister Noda, the Prime Minister of Japan, to make Japan nuke-free, to shut all the nuclear plants. All the nuclear plants were shut in Japan, but he has forced one now to be reopened. We also have two reactors are open in Japan, but the big item is to please get these fuel rods out of the spent fuel pool at Fukushima before they fall over and release more radiation than the human race can survive with. I want to point out also we have a petition at the nukefree.org website. It links to signon.org. We have 3,303 signatures. I'm looking at it now. In light of Fukushima and Solyndra, please stop the rip-off taxpayer loan guarantees for new nuclear reactors in Georgia. There are discussions going on between the White House, the Department of Energy, and the Southern Company, which wants to build two more reactors in Georgia at the Vogtle site. We want that loan guarantee killed, and we want that reactor project stopped. So please sign our petition at nukefree.org. Okay, we've done the housekeeping. Oberon Zell, are you there? You are here.
I am.
Talking to us from Northern California, right?
Yep.
Okay, very good. And Jeff Rosenbaum, are you with us from the north coast of Ohio?
I am here.
Okay, buddy. Well, we're glad to have the both of you with us. It's a pleasure to be talking to two of the mainstays of the Starwood Festival and the neo-pagan community. Oberon, in the second half of our hour, we're going to talk about polyamory.
All right.
Everybody loves to talk about sex.
Yes.
And Oberon, you had a couple of, shall we say, group marriage situations. Is that the situation?
Yes. Morning Glory and I were in two successive group marriages for 10 years each. So really a good part of our life together has been in group marriages. So we have a lot of experience with that.
Good. Good. So we're going to talk about that after the break at 2:30 Eastern time. In the meantime, Oberon, you have a book coming out. Your I guess it's autobiography, called what?
The Witch and the Wizard OZ. Yes,
okay.
It's supposed to be out by the end of this year by Llewellyn, hopefully.
So what's the deal here? What makes you worthy of an autobiography called The Witch and the Wizard of Oz here?
Well, you know, it wasn't really exactly my idea entirely. I was approached by our amanuensis, John Sulak, who had done most of the interviews in the book Modern Pagans. And he's been kind of following me around in my life for, oh my goodness, since 1969 when we met at the World Science Fiction Convention in St. Louis. And he's always wanted to do a life story. So he approached us a few years ago with this, and we said, sure, that'd be fun. I mean, I've always I always used to enjoy biographies when I was a kid. When I was a teenager, I read all these biographies of people I thought were interesting, and I used to think, well, how can I live my life so that somebody would find it to be a good story and maybe make a movie out of it? So every episode of my life,
well,
I've sort of envisioned,
Oberon,
you know, how this looked
to
on film.
Oberon, just to update our viewers and listeners, I have met you, and you are the spitting image of Robert Redford, so I don't think having a movie made about you would be any problem at all. So go ahead.
Well, that was basically it. So I think I have lived an interesting life all those years. And I used to say that, well, if my life story ever was told, it would have to be written as science fiction. And so anyway, John approached us and interviewed us for countless hours and hours and hours and hours, and then transcribed all these interviews. And then we turned him on to a whole bunch of friends and family over the years, including our parents and kids and you know, siblings and everything, and he interviewed all of them, and then he gave us all the stuff, and we filled in the blanks, and we created a vast document of memoirs. And then, of course, that was really pretty much unpublishable, since it was just a huge collection of anecdotes and such.
Well, tell us
and
some
so
of the anecdotes.
I want
to hear some of this. Oberon, I want to hear some of the stories. Let's hear some of the stories of your life that make it autobiography worthy.
Well, there was the years that we lived out in the woods and homesteaded in the mountains in a big hippie community. There was the great unicorn adventure where we rediscovered the secrets of unicorns and bred them
back
into the
world. All right, well, tell us, what's the secret of unicorn?
Well, it's a technique, really, that had been lost and rediscovered several times throughout history and became mythologized for causing the proto-horn tissue of any horned animal to unite in the center of the forehead and grow as a single horn instead of as two separate horns. And the effects of this are really quite astonishing. And the profound discovery was that unicorns in all these ancient depictions and descriptions were actually real animals rather than just some made up mythical creatures. And so we pursued this, and we succeeded. We brought unicorns back to the world. We toured all over North America doing Renaissance fairs, and eventually we leased several of them to the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus, and they took it worldwide, and it was a huge adventure. So that was one of the things we did. That was in the 80s, and then right after that, we embarked on a diving expedition to New Guinea in search of mermaids, and that was another amazing adventure.
Well, did you find any? What's the situation with the mermaid population here?
Well, we discovered what was the actual origin basis of the mermaid legend. We actually found the actual animals that were being described. They turned out, of course, as is usually the case in such things, not to be exactly like we expected. But nonetheless, it was a fascinating adventure, and we solved a mystery. And we went on to other things. And after that, you know, we went on to form our first group marriage, the Triskelion marriage. We'll talk about that more with Diane Darling. We published Green Egg, revived Green Egg Publishing again, and Church of All Worlds, and travel all over the world. Had many adventures in far off places, from South America to Australia to, well, wherever we could get to. Now, we've had quite an interesting life, I guess. Anyway, some people seem to think it was interesting enough to be worthy of a book. So the current project now that's wrapping up is to extract a storyline from all of this and be able to put it in the form of a story with narrative and background and all the rest of the stuff. So that's,
well, you, Oberon, helped coin the phrase neo-pagan.
Yes.
And describe to us, please, what constitutes a pagan existence? What kind of a life have you led that would be so different from the mainstream?
Well, paganism literally means of the land. The pagans are people of the land. And paganism can most easily be described as nature worship. I like the term green religion to put it in our contemporary context. And it's really the old religion, what people used to do back in the ancient times before we got roped into or converted into these monotheistic, prophetic, empire-building religions. But this is just the simple tribal religion, the indigenous religion. It's also classical religions of ancient civilizations like Greece and Rome and Egypt and Sumeria and all these places, Native American, islanders, indigenous peoples everywhere. All of this is pagan, really. And so it's a very broad concept, but there are many things that are in common that one finds among all these. There's the nature worship. There's the common veneration of Mother Earth as the source of all life. Everybody understands that. Everybody knows who she is everywhere.
That's involved with the Gaia concept.
It is, very much. I was the first person in modern times, really, to articulate what has now become a very widespread concept of Gaia, of the Earth as a single vast living entity. And I developed and wrote this up extensively in a series of papers starting in 1970, just preceding James Lovelock's more popularized concept of what he called the Gaia hypothesis, which he first published in 1973, several years later. And that caught on in the scientific community, and my version of it had spread throughout the pagan community, so that these two sort of came together. And they're slightly different emphasis. His emphasis was from the outside in, looking at the Earth from an atmospheric biochemist point of view, and noting that the atmospheric composition of the Earth seemed to be artificial in the sense of created by living systems, whereas mine was a biological internal one. My thesis basically is that evolution has simply been nothing more than embryology on a planetary scale. The entire history of evolution originates with a single original cell that in current scientific terms is called LUCA, L-U-C-A, the last universal common ancestor. And it's just as our individual lives as a person starts with a single fertilized cell, a zygote, from which all of the complexity of trillions and trillions of cells that we have derive, but we still remain one being, the same thing happened in the history of life on Earth. From the original cell, the same DNA and the same protoplasm courses through every cell, every being, every plant and animal on the entire planet. And so the biosphere of Earth is literally one single vast superorganism. And we've always understood this as Mother Earth, Mother Nature.
Interesting. Jeff Rosenbaum, you are the co-founder, a founder, and a sustainer of the Starwood Festival, which has been going for how many years now? 31?
32.
The 32 years of the Starwood Festival. Every summer, a bunch of pagan hippies gather in the woods somewhere, and it's been in upstate New York, and now it's in southeastern Ohio, and dance around a big fire and have workshops and talk about things and do things relating to the earth and to the pagan creed, I suppose. Oberon has been a guest at your festival for decades. Tell us about some of the other people who've been at Starwood.
Starwood is kind of unique in that we are a meeting of different communities. And one of the communities that we have always been involved in is the consciousness exploration community, which encompasses the psychedelic revolution and the entheogenic revolution. And that has included people like Timothy Leary and Robert Anton Wilson, and Terence McKenna, Jonathan Ott, Ralph Metzner, Paul Krasner, Jay Stevens, David J. Brown, a lot of the people who have been in the forefront of the fringe exploration of the realms of consciousness. And I say fringe in terms of the acceptance by society rather than being fringe as a science. You know, much of what they studied has become quite common, quite accepted parts. You know, things like biofeedback And as Timothy Leary said, group therapy was once considered just as crazy an idea and just as completely out of bounds as using psychedelic drugs. I remember him saying that when he was part of a group that first started talking about group therapy, people were saying, "Are you crazy? That's not only insane; it's illegal, and you wouldn't want people to do surgery on themselves. You wouldn't give the scalpel to the patient. Why would you want people to do therapy on each other?" And but now group therapy is as common as any other kind of psychological therapy. So, you know, a lot of other things like biofeedback, sensory isolation, neuro-linguistic programming, meditation. You know, during the time of Freud, hypnosis was considered some sort of weird, you know, African mumbo jumbo or something that a fakir would use, and now hypnosis is used as a common technique in psychotherapy.
Interesting. You said neuro-linguistic programming. Tell us about that. That's a wild one.
Well, it's not something that I can explain that well, but the basic idea is that we're all programmed. We all, if you use as a model for the mind, the computer, and you think in terms of your programming and your ability to people like Leary and Wilson spoke about metaprogramming, the idea of getting down to the root programming that you have and trying to change it by the use of therapy and in their case by the use of psychedelic substances. But there are many different techniques that can be used to try to get down to the point where you put your hands on the control panel of your own programming and get a chance to change, to identify undesirable programs and change them.
Interesting. Oberon, is that part of the pagan Gaian panoply here of things that we like to do in the new world here, the new age?
Well, actually, it is, interestingly enough, because this has been the foundation of shamanism, and shamanism is sort of the inner mystery of all pagan traditions. Every pagan village, tribe, culture, people has its shamans, have been called the witch doctors or the medicine people, or later on the witches and wizards, the people who move comfortably through different realms and alternative realities and shifted their consciousness. And most of them did this by eating things like magic mushrooms or smoking funny plants and things like that, because these substances, these naturally occurring vegetable substances, seem to have an interesting psychosymbiosis with the rise of consciousness and of humanity, because the chemicals they put out, we have receptor sites for them in our brains. It's really quite fascinating. And these transform us. Terence McKenna said that we attained consciousness and became really human by following the reindeer herds around and other animals and then eating the magic mushrooms that grew out of their shit, you know? So there may be a great deal to that. I think it probably is. And so all tribal cultures have their shamans, and the shamans eat these things and enter into the dreaming and the other worlds and fairy and whatever people want to call it, the dream time, and come back with messages and visions and things that help to change and shift the culture. Or when people get sick, they will go into the other world and retrieve their soul and bring it back for them. And it's a whole world of stuff, and it directly relates to what Tim Leary and Ralph Metzner and Richard Alpert were doing clear back in Millbrook. You know, they were using it for therapy and healing and psychotherapy. And so there's that psychotherapeutic aspect to the shaman's work as the doctor, as it were, the psychopomp, the psychiatrist, really, of the people. But there's also the personal one, because these people didn't just do it for other people. They also went on their own adventures. It's said that in a tribal culture, the shamans are the only people who actually like to go into these alternative realities. Other people will put up with it because they have to for the medicine. They have to take the medicine to get healed, but they don't like it. But the shamans are explorers and adventurers in these realms, and they travel into these alternative realities through use of these substances, and they bring back important information and revelations. So yes, the answer is yes.
Well, yeah, the thing that was that I'm
Jeff,
sorry.
Jeff Rosenbaum, go ahead. Let me interject here. We're talking with Oberon Zell, master wizard, coiner of the phrase neo-pagan, and a originator of the dialogue on Gaia. And Jeff Rosenbaum, mainstay of the Starwood Festival, which the Starwood Pagan Festival, which just occurred in southeastern Ohio, been going for 32 years. After the break, we're going to talk about polyamory and the rise and fall of monogamy. Jeff, go ahead, please. Jeff Rosenbaum, Cleveland.
I was going to say that, you know, we've always had our shamans. We've always had our explorers into the realms of altered consciousness in order to be able to bring back that wisdom and that those inspirations that you can get by changing your outlook and changing your point of view when looking at these at mundane phenomenon. But the thing that was unique about the 60s is that it became a pop culture phenomenon. The usually these things are studied by some small group of people, like within the Masons. Most of the Masons were into it for the fraternity and the brotherhood and the contacts they could make. And then there was this small group within the Masons that were really into the esoteric stuff. And the other people looked at them kind of weird, but they're glad that somebody is doing it. And it's keeping that stuff alive, but it wasn't the cup of tea of most of the people who were Masons. And that's the way esoteric sciences have been, in a way, all sciences have been throughout history. Usually there's some small group of people who are really into exploring consciousness, exploring esoteric sciences, and most people find that it's not really something that they either understand or want to explore. But that strange thing happened in the 60s where millions and millions of people got on board into the psychedelic revolution. And it caused a revolution in thinking in various ways, a revolution in art and music and other kind of cultural forms of expression. And when it went away, people thought, "Oh my God, this terrible thing has happened. The dream is over." And actually, it just sort of went back to where it usually is in terms of being a minority interest. And yet, that minority has always generated ideas that the majority took advantage of and incorporated into society.
We referred to a generation of shamans is how we used to think of it at that time.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. A generation of shamans. Would that be Tim Leary and Richard Alpert and Paul Krasner and Stephen Gaskin, all of whom? I don't know. Have you had Ram Dass at Starwood, Jeff?
No, we've never had Ram Dass there. We did have Ralph Metzner. We had some of the more recent people like Are You Serious and Jay Stevens and David J. Brown. And some of the people who sort of, Jonathan Ott, other people who sort of carried this message on and this research on, although they're just, as is usual in human history, they're not superstars. You know, the fact that there were people like Ken Kesey and Timothy Leary who were world-renowned celebrities in these realms is the anomaly.
Well, you know, what really kicked it off was Aldous Huxley with his Doors of Perception and Heaven and Hell and stuff, which came out right at around 1960 or something like that.
Well, you mean Aldous Huxley and Elvis Presley. They're kind of like great twins there, don't you think?
I don't know about Elvis Presley. I don't know if he did this or not, but Aldous Huxley certainly was the first person I ever encountered who wrote about these subjects and really interested people in that early generation of those of us who started college at the beginning of the 60s, that was one of the main things we picked up on, and Leary, I'm sure, was one of them.
And of course, Houston and Masters, and some of the Gene Houston and Robert Masters, who wrote Mind Games. And there were other people, Burroughs. There were a lot of people who were doing this in literature, and the stream of consciousness writing. And if you go back a little bit further, you have the people who were introducing us to other realms through laudanum and opium.
Oh, yeah, right.
And all sorts of other kinds of things. People like Blake and Coleridge. But again, these people were famous among small groups of people. You know, the people who were really into those folks. They weren't pop culture heroes.
At right. least, a lot of them were only known academically. For example, Mercier Eliade in his book on shamanism was a very important thing, but it was a very academic book that wasn't widely read outside of it. So this phenomenon generally started, like the pagan movements as well, in colleges by people who were exploring and investigating these realms. And cultural anthropology was really the field that kind of almost initiated the entire movement, both in psychedelics as well as paganism.
And this went hand in hand with exploration of different kinds of spirituality. People like Isaac Bonowitz, who wrote Real Magic, originally as his master's thesis, and started the biggest druidic organization in America. And Robert Heinlein.
Let's just interrupt for a moment. We have a caller, Dave from San Francisco. Dave, are you on?
Oh, yeah. Hi, Harvey. And your guests. You know, I have been struck by this issue of what you're talking about with the esoteric sciences for many years, about whether or not sciences were kept for the elect few as opposed to allowing the general public to get involved. And as you opened your show this afternoon, Harvey, you mentioned Fukushima. And it strikes me that if we were to leave the general public uneducated about nuclear science, then in 50 years or 150 years or 1,000 years, for example, that section of Japan would have a ghostly taint of poisoning, and it could become known as a superstitious zone. And so just the idea of sections of the world that become superstitious zones, you know, Transylvania, you know, things like that. Why, where Transylvania, apparently they had a lot of gold and silver in the ground, and so creating a superstitious zone there would be to the advantage of people to not get invaded. So I'm just wondering about the idea of esoteric knowledge and the true sciences.
Who wants to take that, Oberon, Jeff?
Well, I wouldn't. I wouldn't call them the esoteric versus true sciences, and I wouldn't say that people are really kept out of these kind of sciences by anything except their desire and ability to understand the language within which they can be studied, like mathematics. You can't really study nuclear physics without being able to understand mathematics a lot more than I can. But we all get the fruits of these sciences, and we're all affected by them. And at the time, if there's anything we are kept away from, it is the uncomfortable consequences of these sciences when there are organizations like the nuclear power industry that really don't want us to dwell on these things. They don't really want us to comprehend the other side of that coin. They just want to tell you, hey, your power is going to be cheaper if you build more nuclear power plants.
Yeah, it's not the sciences so much that's hidden in these areas. So that's available to anybody who cares to do the research, which is usually fairly published and all. But it's the politics. There's where it starts getting really weird, because that's very secretive, because it involves people making a lot of money off of this stuff, and they really don't want people to know how much money they're making and what they're doing with it, and to see their tax returns.
Okay, do we want to talk more about esoteric science after the break? Let's pick that up there, and we'll talk about polyamory and monogamy. This is the Soultopia Green Power and Wellness Show, a wonderful show. Dave from San Francisco, you're welcome to stay with us. Oberon Zell and Jeff Rosenbaum of the Starwood Festival, the Pagan Community, the Neo-Pagan Gaian Community. We will come back after this break and talk about polyamory.
Top gardens, biogeothermal power, family community, healthy children, and lots of forest for the bear. Solar Topia is
mostly hot. Will you please talk with me? All right, when you come back. Hello, we are back with the Soultopia Green Power Hour. This is Harvey Wasserman. We're with Oberon Zell and Jeff Rosenbaum from the Starwood Festival. Dave from San Francisco, are you still with us?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. All right. Oberon.
No, I'm a, That was today. This is Jeff.
Oh, all right. Well,
sorry.
Oberon Zell, you are a pioneer in polygamy and group marriage, and what were you calling it? Polyamory. There we go. That's when a woman named Polly hooks up with a guy named Amory. tell us about your experiments in group marriage.
Well, I should start off by clarifying it's not quite the same as polyamory and polygamy are not quite exactly the same thing. Polygamy essentially means marrying several people, which I have certainly done, but polyamory means loving several people, which doesn't necessarily require you to get married to them. So I think that distinction needs to be clarified. And we really don't like to get mixed up with the concept of what the Mormons' polygamy thing is about, because that's a very specific and rather bizarre pattern where one old guy ends up marrying a whole bunch of teenage girls and young women, and you only allow one husband in that structure, but lots of wives. And in our system, we feel that, you know, there should be as many husbands as want to be and wives as want to be, and whoever wants to be together should be able to be together. We kind of apply that across the board to relationships and marriage, like, you know, gay marriage, multiple marriage, whatever. If people want to make a commitment to live their lives together, then who should tell them not to? Kind of the way we feel about it. The polyamory is a very interesting pattern of multiple relationships, which has always been with us. I mean, really, this monogamy thing that people have created, and the monomery, the living only one person, that part of it that's built into the system, it seems, is not universal by any means, and nor has it ever been. It's never been unusual for people to fall in love with more than one person at a time. And in the structure of the monogamy model, of course, that becomes really quite an awful situation. I mean, half of the crimes and most of the movies and novels and romance stories and everything else are all about the problems that arise when people find themselves falling in love with somebody else when they're already in one relationship. But it doesn't have to be that way, you know. Then polyamory.
Well, tell
me about
that. What are the problems and what are the solutions when someone's in a relationship and meets someone else and wants to be with them? But there are kids involved and family and all that stuff. How do we handle that?
Well, if you can just bring them all together and make the family bigger, then it all works. And that's really kind of what polyamory is about. It means that you don't really have to, if you fall in love with somebody else, you don't have to give up your previous relation. It's like that scene in the Addams Family, first Addams Family movie that said, well, or second one, well, when a new kid is born into the family, you don't have to kill the other ones, you know, you just add them in. And the same thing can be true for relationships. If you're sophisticated and mature enough to be able to have really deep love relationships, then adding more doesn't necessarily threaten the one you've got any more than adding more kids threatens your relationships with the ones you have. And this model was brilliantly articulated and came to our attention first in Robert Heinlein's novel Stranger in a Strange Land, where he just simply laid it all out. And in the process of the of editing the initial published version in 1961, which, by the way, is not in the subsequent supposedly unedited version that his wife released 20 years later. The original version that was published in 1961, he gave a definition of love, which is really foundational to the whole polyamory movement. And that is, love is that condition wherein another person's happiness is essential to your own. And this is not about ownership and property rights and jealousy and possessiveness and all the rest of that stuff. It's a matter of simply, if you love somebody, you want them to be happy. I mean, you really, really want them to be happy. I mean, you can't be happy unless they're happy, kind of thing. There are problems in that. I mean, if you get involved with somebody who, for various reasons, is fundamentally unhappy, it's really challenging. But it's a much better model than the one with possession and jealousy regarded as the concomitants of love. So we started off, I mean, my adult life in going off to college all coincided with the publication of Stranger in a Strange Land. And so that became the kind of the model for which we developed our earliest relationships, me and my friends in those days. And the act that is the fundamental act of this is a ritualized sharing of water, which is sort of like the old traditional blood brother thing where you cut your hand the sharing of blood. Sharing of water has that sense of a deep bond that you're sharing the same water, which is the universal essence of life itself. So you say water shared is life shared, and you make a commitment. And my first really good friend Lance Christie and I, who met in our first year of the first week of college in 1961, read that book and shared water with that commitment, became Water Brothers 50 years ago on April 7th, 1962. And we lived our entire life over these last 50 years with that commitment, in that sense that we wanted to build a different kind of world, a better world, where people like us could live and thrive. And that involved more than just us living it ourselves. It also meant having to develop a community, and then larger than that, a movement, and larger than that, a world-transforming cultural shift in all these things. It's a whole paradigm shift. So, and that included polyamory. It included the idea of developing relationships of numerous people, all happily interconnecting. And sexuality, sex, of course, which is a lot of fun and we all really enjoy, it's not the whole picture. It's only really part of it. To have a deep relationship, you know, how much sex can you do? You know, I mean, you know, even maxing out, you know, there's still a limit. But the rest of the time, you're still hanging out together. You're still doing things together. You're still enjoying a life together and you know, having meals and conversations and all the rest of it, raising kids.
Well,
so it all works. There really isn't any downside. That's the thing about it. If you just simply get past the idea that you have to own somebody else, then everything just works beautifully.
One of the things that are upsides to this, and most people don't understand it, especially when you talk about polygamy, most people who haven't been in these situations or haven't really studied it, all they think about is this is sort of a personal indulgence. You're trying to have more sex, more people to have sex with, and it's like an unending orgy or something. And they always end up saying, but what about the children? Well, there are some definite upsides to polygamy when it comes to children. And I'm not talking about, as you say, the irresponsible examples of these Mormon fathers with their teenagers. I'm talking about the fact that children rarely get orphaned in a situation where they have multiple parents. There is they are not dependent on only one or two people's lives in order to continue to have a family. Another thing is, if there's somebody in the relationship who does indulge in improper behavior, it's caught a lot sooner, and there's more support within the family to do something about it if there are more wives. You know, an abusive father or husband doesn't have much hope if there's three wives that he's going to have to contend with who can unite and stop this kind of behavior or notice it if it involves children. There's a lot of upsides to a big extended family, which is something that naturally occurs when you have the more spouses you have, the more family members you have, because each of them have parents and they have to have other relatives. And as far as the sex goes, Heinlein said that the plural of spouse is spice.
That it takes a village to raise a child, and really the implication is that the more adults around to interact with the kids, the healthier the kids are. And this is absolutely true across the board. I mean, there have been many studies on this. This is why there is so much of a problem with children who are trying to be raised by single parents. It's just too much for one person to handle. But the more you've got, the more backup you've got, the more reinforcement you've got, the more support system you've got. And in our first 10-year triad marriage, Morning Glory and Diane and I each came into it with a child of a previous marriage that we brought. So we had three kids and three adults, and they were all raised as brothers and sisters, and there was always a support system. When one of them had a problem in school, three parents would show up. There would always be somebody to go to their to their soccer games or their concerts or their performances or whatever was going on. There would always be, you know, people there for them. And it wasn't really even a problem in the community. People didn't really find us that weird because there were lots of kids whose parents had divorced and remarried and who might have, you know, three or four parents who would all have a common interest in them. They just might not all live together. In our case, we all lived together, but it wasn't that big a stretch, really, from parents who've simply moved on to encompass other relationships as long as they're still friendly, and certainly we were. And it was just an incredibly rich environment. We had really wonderful times. We had good meals. We did amazing work together. We built a whole community around us. We became a community center for all the other kids. You know, it was fabulous. It's a really terrific way to live. It simply requires making some adjustments in your own expectations and needs to not require exclusivity in your love relationship. But once you get past that, then it's just a straight shot. It's great.
Dave from San Francisco, you got anything to add on that? I guess he's gone.
Well, but then, aren't
Dave's
there,
not here.
Huh?
Dave's not here.
That's
Dave's
okay. He's absent. He's absent from the class. What are the complications here? What are the downsides that you've experienced over on in this kind of group marriage situation? And Jeff, chime in, Jeff Rosenbaum. We're talking with Oberon Zell, a Guyan advocate, coiner of the phrase neo-pagan, and Jeff Rosenbaum, a mainstay for more than 30 years of the Starwood Pagan Festival, just completed in southeastern Ohio. What have the downsides been of this polyamorous situation?
Well, you know, it's really hard to think of any, but one of my husbands, Wolf, used to say that, well, you know, love may be infinite, but time is not. And the real problem is to being able to have enough time to give really quality time to all of the people in multiple relationships. That can be a bit challenging sometimes to simply find the time to give to everybody. But I have not really encountered that as so much of a problem, because there's times when everybody needs to be, you know, some time to themselves or to be able to get off somewhere. And this always means you've got a backup. Like, if I want to go to a movie, I've always got somebody to go with, you know. If Morning Glory is not available or doesn't particularly like that kind of movie, well, I can go with Julie, you know, or Wolf, you know, and we'll go off and we'll see the movie. If Morning Glory wants to go to a horse race, which doesn't interest me, you know, she and Julie and Diane can go off to do it because they love horse racing. So that's one of the nice things about it. And it's, you know, we've talked about this a lot, about what are the downsides, and it's really pretty hard to think of any. In fact, we often say that the biggest downside of monogamy is nobody gets to sleep in the middle.
I would say that if there are downsides, most of them have to do with the interaction with a society that finds this less than acceptable. And usually if your community isn't forced to interact with people who don't approve of you, and this is true of all sorts of things besides polyamory, then those downsides really don't affect you.
Right. That's true.
Well, we're interesting. We're talking with Jeff Rosenbaum of the Starwood Festival, Oberon Zell, a Guyan neo-pagan, about group marriage. And, of course, it would be good if we had a woman chime in on all this. Women have a different point of view than us three guys here rapping away about neo-pagan group marriages. Are you familiar with other group marriages, Oberon, that have worked or not worked? What is the general literature about this?
The thing about that's kind of funny is that we were all doing this stuff for decades in the Church of All Worlds. We built a community of people around who just simply were very comfortable having multiple lovers. We'd go to events and festivals like Starwood and find people and sometimes become lovers. And sometimes they would be just for the festival event. And sometimes we'd take them home and introduce them to the family, and they'd become part of our life for longer periods of time or ongoing. I mean, I'm still in touch with many, many lovers I've known over the years that I haven't really been with exactly, but we still feel good about each other and really happy about it. And the thing is that throughout all of this, the thing moves very smoothly within the context of a supportive community, which we actually created. We simply built it around us by using this as a filter, you know. So So we don't really have people who are hostile. And once people understand we're not expecting them to do anything just because they're a part of it, it's like being a vegetarian, you know. You got to, first thing is to get past the thing that other people somehow expect that you want them to be also. And we don't. We don't care. We don't care at all. So we have lots of friends who are poly and lots of friends who aren't, and it really doesn't matter because relationships are a personal and individual thing, just like having friends who are gay and friends who are het. And who cares, you know?
You know, if I could chime in. Am I on the air?
Is this Dave from San Francisco?
Yeah.
We thought you had disappeared on us, Dave.
Well,
what happened here?
Apparently the phone went dead about a half an hour ago, so I redialed in. Hey, you know, I wanted to raise something tied both with what you're just talking about as well as the previous topic. There was a book that came out about 10 or 15 years ago called Our Stolen Future. It was basically put together by a series of different physicians who realized that pollution was very much changing our lives. And one of the aspects that they were noting in it was that with some of the really volatile chemicals, benzene and whatnot, it's sterilizing a lot of kids. And so where in a natural state you would have a certain percentage, you know, maybe 5 or 7% of the population would be basically sterile, now it's getting into higher numbers. And so I'm just wondering if the polyamory isn't going to be almost necessary for the species to survive at some point. Because there is going to be this point where, you know, kids are being born with basically no sex organs because they're subject to various types of pollution.
Well, that's okay. That's good to inject a little reality into the situation. We're at the Green Power Wellness Show. This is Harvey Wasserman. We're talking with Oberon Zell, neo-pagan leader in the Gaian community, Jeff Rosenbaum, a mainstay of the Starwood Festival, which pagan festival, one of the largest, if not the largest, in the country, after 32 years. And Dave has just given us a stunner here on pollution. I think we're all, of course, Gaians fighting for the survival of our Mother Earth and to have a planet that we can live on. I actually just watched last night on my little computer with the DVD. I watched over three nights Avatar. I wondered, Oberon, do you consider Avatar to be a legitimate Gaian movie?
Oh, yes, absolutely. My goodness, it's really emphasized the idea of the what it is like to live within the concept and the consciousness of a living, conscious planet. And I really feel that one of the things I've been talking about a lot lately is that we are on the threshold of the awakening of Gaia herself, into which we will all participate in this greater consciousness. And I think the movie Avatar shows a really, in a very beautiful way, what that could look like, what that would really be like to have that communion. It isn't that you become lost in some greater consciousness, it's that you can go to a deeper level and be connected with it. And I think that that's really the essence of it. And I think that a lot of us find that experience in certain psychedelic experiences and theogenic shamanic initiations. Really, it takes us down to that deep level where we experience in that cosmic unity with all life and come back with that understanding. I mean, that was certainly a profound experience in my life, and I think lots of people who have journeyed into those realms have had that experience.
Jeff, we're going to have an outdoor showing of Avatar at the next Starwood Festival.
That would be just fine. I mean, it really does illustrate a difference between two outlooks of the world, one in which there is a sacredness that is apprehended and comprehended by the people of Gaia and of the spirit of the planet, and those who think of the planet as an object that was handed over to you either by God or by circumstances for you to do with what you will. If you believe that the world is sacred and that you are part of it, or that nature, more than just the world, but the universe is conscious and sacred and you are a part of it, then the idea of polluting that environment is not just a bottom line decision to make as to whether you think that it's worth that much poison to make that much more money. It's something that's unspeakable to you. It's unthinkable to poison your mother.
Yeah, the most powerful line in the movie Avatar was the statement that the people of Earth had killed their own mother.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I picked up on that again. Yeah, that's pretty, and that they had come to this other planet. They were going around the galaxy, actually, destroying other planets. That's what the theme was of the American, well, not the American, but the Earthian troops who are invading the planet Pandora to rip out the insanely expensive unobtainium metal. And Dave from San Francisco, when you talked about the pollution that's leading to these horrible disfigurements of young children, then that's where we're at. So, well, this has been the Soarotopia Green Power Hour. We got just a couple more minutes left. Oberon Zell, you have a book called Grimoire for the Journeyman Wizard. What is that?
That's the next one. My first book was Grimoire for the Apprentice Wizard, which a very successful book. And in fact, it became the number one bestseller for our publishing company, New Page. And it spawned the Gray School of Wizardry, and lots of things have grown from that, and including a whole series of other books. And the next one in that series that I really have not fully embarked upon yet, I just have notes, will be called The Grimoire for the Journeyman Wizard that takes...
What's a grimoire?
Well, a grimoire is a handbook, basically. It's where we get our word grammar, as in a textbook of information. It's the basis of, a cookbook is a grimoire, really, something or other for dummies. These are grimoires, really. But specifically, the term has come appropriated to magical book textbooks. So it's a basic kind of a magical manual and cookbook of everything you need to know.
Interesting. Jeff, wrapping up here, what's the next latest from Starwood? When's it going to be next year, and who are you going to have?
Next year, I believe the dates are July 9th through 15th, and I couldn't tell you yet who we're going to have, although I know Badal Roy, the tabla player who was with Miles Davis, and who was at Starwood this year, would like to come back, and we're looking at the possibility of bringing in Maruga Booker, who was one of the... members of Merle Saunders' Rainforest Band.
All right.
And
well,
the Ditch Dome that we created is going to be moved to Tradara, which is the Druid place in Madison, Wisconsin, Madison, Ohio, and that's going to be happening today.
Wonderful. It's been a great hour, Dave from San Francisco. Thanks for calling in. We've been with Oberon Zell, Gaia Neo-Pagan, and Jeff Rosenbaum, a mainstay of the Starbucks Festival. The second hour went even faster than the first one, guys. Thank you so much. Next week we'll be talking about when the biomass hits the wind turbine, talking about renewable energy and the community also here in Ohio for renewables, green power. This has been the Soarotopia Green Power and Wellness Show with Harvey Wasserman. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next week in Soarotopia. Soarotopia, Soarotopia, don't you know?